Welcome back to another episode of the Placeholder Podcast, everybody. I'm Caleb Fretz. We got a great show for you today. On today's show, Jumbo's bus crashes almost as much as Primoz Roglic. Remco has grievances. Lachlan Morton just wants a bit of sleep. And wheels keep getting bigger. Joining me today, Johnny Long. Welcome back. First time since the Champs. How was your August?
It was good. As soon as I told you that was the last time I podcasted, I realized I was just sort of telling my boss how much I'd been off work. And in America, and in American culture, I know that time off isn't a thing. It's like the opposite of France, where you're off all the time. So
deeply illegal here.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's okay. We're appropriating a bit of French culture and allowing our staff to go on holiday a bit extra. I think it's worthwhile. Kit Nicholson, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back.
Before we get into the Vuelta and Remco and Lachlan Morton and all the rest, we of course need to hype up our membership. Head over to escapecollective.com/join, where you can become a reader for $6.99 US dollars per month. Or if you want the full membership, Discord access, all the rest, the ability to, for example, ask us questions, as we're going to hear later in the show, that's $11.99 US dollars per month. You could save 30% if you become a yearly member. I do want to thank a couple lifetime members, as always. Josh Freeman. Josh is actually my neighbor. He's across the street right now. I could walk over and thank him in person. So thank you, Josh, for being a lifetime member. John Jenkins, Chris Cosentino. Chris, quite a famous chef. Michael Cassie and Teej Taylor. Wow, this is just a pile of people that I know quite well. Teej Taylor was the officiant at my wedding. So thanks to Teej for being a lifetime. Yeah, he was also the Teej was the president and sort of coach of my collegiate cycling team back in the day, which is also where I met my wife. So hence him being the officiant at our wedding. This is quite random that two of the five people that we're thanking today are quite close to me. But huge thanks to neighbor Josh and officiant Teej, as well, of course, as Chris Cosentino, Michael Casey, and John Jenkins.
This is when we find out the entire company is basically a pyramid scheme. So that's good.
All of the members are actually just friends of mine. That's where we've ended up. All right, let's get into today's show. So we're going to kick off with a bit of chaos at the Vuelta a España, which of course began over the weekend. As always, if you want sort of a deep dive into some of the racing analysis, head over to the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast. We're going to talk about some of the major storylines that came out of the weekend, though. Kit, well, the major storyline was chaos, crashes and rain and darkness and team time trials. And tell me what happened.
Well, yeah, we've had a lot of weather, which is a sentence that you hear a lot in sport and nowhere else. Especially living in Scotland when it's just life. But anyway, Saturday started with a team time trial, which is always a nice thing about the Vuelta. Throws that in for the teams to, test themselves. But for reasons known to nobody, I think, it was at night time and under torrential rain. So it was chaotic. And it was won by Team DSM, who was one of the first teams off, and young Italian under 23 time trial champion Lorenzo Milesi ended up in the red jersey. Stage two, more of the same weather, which was miserable. And as a result of that, there was an extreme weather protocol whereby the GC times were taken quite close to the finish, which led to this strange situation of basically saying and go to the stage hunters. Andreas Kron came out on top after probably the strangest 7 kilometers of bike racing I've seen. And then things returned to a little bit of normality, at least in Vuelta terms, on Monday with the first summit finish. The GC riders got to play. Remco Evenepoel used his punch at the finish to take a second over, was it Vingegaard in second, Ayuso in third? But then he crashed just beyond the finish line and did his interview having just wiped his face of blood. And then if, I mean, the Vuelta's ever going to return to normality, that was the last 2 days when we had sprints, both won by Caden Groves.
Well done, Caden Groves. Can we talk a little bit about the crash here? I don't want to spend too much time on this. I feel like it's been discussed at length in bicycle media and elsewhere. But it was quite a strange circumstance. It kind of looked to me like the Vuelta organizers had set up the finish in the way that they do sort of true mountaintop finishes, ignoring the fact that like the last 20, 30 meters of the race, in addition to the bit after the finish line, were actually flat or slightly downhill. So instead of like sort of coming across the line and rolling to a relatively abrupt stop, Remco Evenepoel came over the top at like 40k an hour and couldn't stop, which seems like something that maybe could have been foreseen for anybody who had been there and looked at the finish, perhaps.
Well, if it had been Roglic, he'd have been stopping his computer at the top and it wouldn't have happened.
Also very true. Was this the Vuelta's fault? Was this the organizer's fault? Was this just Remco like keeping his hands in the air for too long? Because, I mean, nobody else fell down. He was the only one.
I mean, I would say maybe when you take it as part of the whole that we've seen in the past 5 days, I mean, one of the most egregious moments that I felt, well, maybe it was because of all the other bad moments we've had, was the crash towards the finish yesterday when Marijn Vandenberg came round in the lead, came around the last corner and then crashed into what was essentially a wall. It was just, so the design of the corner had kinked inwards at the widest point, which was just terrible course design. And that just made me kind of think, oh, it's another tick on the we're doing a great job here sort of list of the Vuelta. But yeah, the Evenepoel thing, I mean,
they put a wall in the racing line.
Exactly what they did, yeah. And mercifully, it was decently padded by the looks of it. But yeah, it was just like Marijn Vandenberg came around trying to get the lead, which looked like a reasonable tactic because Milano came second, having got that lead through the corner. But yeah, the guy was completely screwed by the course design. So on top of what happened with Remco, yeah, it's just bad planning. But at the same time, you should have maybe been looking where you're going.
For the first three stages of the Vuelta, I had like real life things to attend, so I couldn't just sit on my sofa and watch bike racing. And trying to catch up with every single
journalist.
Yeah. But trying to catch up with like everything on Tuesday morning that had happened was like impossible. Because you're seeing like all these different GIFs and like photos and video clips of Remco, and you're like, how has this one guy managed to fit all of these different things into just 3 days? And one of them was a time trial, which is even that long.
So here's kind of my follow-up question here. One of the things that's kind of come out of the last couple of days is this sentiment, or actually hasn't come out of the last couple of days, but it's been maybe reinforced for some people. I was watching this discussion happen on our member Discord as to whether Remco kind of standing up and talking about these things, whether it's complainy, whingy, or sort of like Patron-esque, right? Because one of the other things that we saw, and in particular on the sort of neutralized end of the stage, was we saw Jonas Vingegaard kind of like come to the front of the race and slow the whole thing down and do kind of Patron stuff that we haven't seen from him before. Remco is kind of standing up for, you could look at it as standing up for the peloton in some of these things. We haven't really had a sort of Patron figure in quite some time. And for those that don't really know what I'm talking about, like the classic here is you know, you go back to like Lance Armstrong as sort of the guy who would yell at the rest of the peloton and refuse to let people into breakaways and generally sort of quite heavy-handed. But there's been others over the years that have been a little bit less
Cancellara.
Controversial. Yeah. Cancellara was sort of the patron for a while, and they end up sort of being like de facto like union leaders, right? Mm-hmm. Like they stand for the rest of the peloton, and that's kind of the whole idea. Is that what Remco is trying to do? I guess I was watching this debate kind of happen again on our Discord, that this half the people thinking, no, he's like kind of taking control and standing up for like peloton safety. And the other half is saying he's just complaining constantly, because basically at the end of every single stage so far, he's had something to bitch and moan about, but maybe validly.
I think after the first stage, when he, you know, gesticulated at the heavens and swore a bit. And I think it, the immediate reaction was based on his reputation as the young whippersnapper who's a bit hot-headed. And we've seen that before. And, you know, whether it's pulling on Ben Turner to stop him from moving up a group. I can't remember.
Yeah.
It was a smaller race. It was it Belgium Tour or something a few years ago? Anyway, it was those sorts of moments where it's like, hang on, no, that's a little bit, that's not on. But then, so on Saturday, I was impressed with how quickly he went from this is stupid and dangerous in a kind of aggressively complainy way to actually very eloquently explaining why he felt this was so dangerous. And it was valid because it was... Those pictures that you see, it's like going to the cinema and one of these Marvel movies that is way, not a Marvel movie, a DC movie that's way too dark. And it's and it's like, you know, you can't see anything. And I mean, I've never raced a time trial, but I imagine it helps to know where you're going or to be able to see where you're going. I think he's at risk of, I mean, he's already getting it, isn't he? He's getting it in the neck, being cocky and above his station. But I have been impressed by how eloquent and well, he's got a point. I wasn't quite so delighted by the facial expression he was pulling when he did win the stage. I was like, it's slightly smug.
The De Niro.
Very smug. Yeah.
But I have been, my estimation of him has been on the rise in a personal way, you know, at least where his, I don't know, the way he approaches things.
I think he's just great fun. Like, there are some things that I find a bit sort of too much, like the Pizza Hut endorsements, and then just his general sort of the way he conducts himself on Instagram, like in comments and sort of captions. It's just a bit, that's not my bag. But then he's halfway to becoming like a Tadej Pogacar-esque meme. Like when he did there's that clip of when Tobias Foss beat him at the World Time Trial Championships last year and he was like mouthing Foss in like disbelief. That was great. And then I was watching the Lantern Rouge guy doing his breakdown of the whole Patron thing, like of trying to quieten everyone down. And he had some great analysis of how him and Vingegaard did different, like their hands were different sort of levels in the air. And how that sort of contributed to, like, one was more polite and then Remco's was a bit more forceful. And I just, I want all the, like, the cockiness thing. I think if you're winning, then, like, you can, like, the reason you can be that smug when you come across the line is because you are that good and you've just beaten those guys. I don't know. It's entertaining.
Well, but, like, so here's the thing is that he's in this race with the guy who's just won the last two Tours de France, who... You know, by any sort of normal measure, like that guy is the patron of this current peloton, right? But we know that Jonas Vingegaard is not maybe that personality. We saw a bit of it so far this Vuelta, but as you point out, his was a little bit more subdued. He's more interested, I think, in speaking to the rest of the peloton and controlling the rest of the peloton, whereas Remco is interested in being the voice of the peloton with media. And those are two very different approaches to similar problems.
Yeah, we saw images of Vingegaard going and talking to Enric Mas, didn't we, before stage two, when they were talking about how they were not going to attack, and it looked like there was a little bit of lost in translation, or Mas kind of wanted to race, even though it wasn't really his stage. But it was that kind of...
Classic Enric Mas.
Yeah, there was a politeness, there were manners about it. And I'm not saying that Remco Evenepoel isn't a well-mannered chap, although I'm not sure I'd call him a chap. I don't know. That's getting into some...
Is he a lad?
A bit more laddie than chap, yeah. A bit more geezer. I don't know.
he's geezers for us are old people.
Oh, geezer. He's a nice guy. Like, even... I've interacted with him, like, a fair amount in terms of, like, in-person and online, like, press conferences and, like, small huddles and stuff. And he's, like, perfectly nice. And, like, I've never seen him be bratty or anything. And I think also you have to have, like, all these different personalities. Like, if they're all just, like... Like, we complain about how, like, riders never say anything and just, like, give maximum respect to the opponents and never single anyone out. Like, I want someone to be like, oh, like, it's dark and we're trying to time trial. Or, like, why have they got the people at the finish, like, 50 metres past the line? Like, express yourself, Remco Evenepoel.
Yeah, I'm kind of for it. All right, let's not spend too much more time on that. As you said, Kit, the last two stages won by Caden Groves. Of course, we're recording this on Wednesday, so we don't know. There's going to be one more stage in between when we recorded this and when you listen, so hopefully nothing interesting happens. There's been a couple other kind of strange things out of the Pro Peloton. So, Johnny, this Marco Brenner DSM Firmenich, what is this? This is not the first time we're seeing weird saddle height issues from this team. What is going on?
This team is just so mad. And the thing is as often as these things happen, every time you read them and you're just like, how? So the crux of it is that Marco Brenner has sort of been a bit, he's like a young German guy, like very well touted for the future. I think he's early 20s now, maybe 21. He's been like injured for a few years, or not at the level he would expect. And he'd like, it's a chronic back injury stemming from a year 2020 accident involving a tractor, which I can't really find much more about, but it doesn't sound great. And then a while ago, he realized that he could help his sort of back issue and injury if he changed his saddle height and setup. And at most teams, this would be fine. If they'd be like, you know what, you fixed it, well done, that's great. At DSM, that's not how things work. And if you want to change your saddle height, there is like a committee to change the saddle height or to change various things. And there's like a guy, or one person sits at the top of the committee, then there's like meetings and notes. And then it's like, basically the rider can't decide their saddle height. It's decided for you. So Marco Brenner was just like, you know, I'm just going to do it. And then he didn't tell the team. The team found out. He got taken out of the Vuelta squad, like with a week to go. And he'd been preparing for it for a long time. As sort of an active, retribution is the wrong word, but sort of because as punishment. Which he accepted. He's like, fine, these are the rules, the weird team that I ride for. But then they wouldn't even put him in to hit the Deutschland Tour, like his home stage race. Like that was also deemed too much of a reward for his poor behavior. And they're like, oh, you can go race in Canada in like a month's time. So he's like, well, this sucks. And maybe when my contract comes up for renewal at the end of 2024, I'm going to leave.
So assuming we're not missing something here and he didn't, you know, do something in addition to the seat post height. But we should say that this has happened before with this particular team. This exact thing has happened before with this team. So it all checks out.
Mm.
This is insane.
Yeah, it's nuts.
It's insane. It is insane behavior from this team. And they wonder why they can't hang on to anybody of any talent.
We should probably point out that they have hung on to some talent, though. Maybe it's not the sort of talent that wins all the time, but they do hold on to some people. And they are drawing Warren Barguil back, although maybe no, I don't know, maybe there was something else. Like, he's towards the end of his career and he will go back.
Yeah.
Because they'll pay him. But, you know, there are a few Aussies that have stuck around. Romain Bardet seems reasonably happy, although nobody seems to count him as a GC rider anymore now that he's at DSM, which is a bit odd. Maybe he isn't, I don't know. But yeah, it's... sorry, I'm bringing my kind of my devil's advocate. Maybe something. I definitely think it's bananas what's happening over there. But it worked. I think it seems to be working for some people. I don't know.
I mean, I guess it's gonna. Yeah, it will work for some people in the same way that
Team Sky works for some people.
Exactly. Like less so these days, but sort of back in the day when Team Sky was quite a bit more controlling. It worked for some riders and it didn't work for others, right? And like I remember chatting with Joe Dombrowski because he signed with them very young, like straight out of his sort of like baby Giro time, and only lasted about 2 years, never really got much of an opportunity, and he just never really got on with the team. That's just the reality. Ian Boswell signed at the same time, lasted much longer, ended up on the tour squad. Two different sort of trajectories there. So yeah, like different types of teams can work for different types of riders, but I'm sorry, if you need a committee to change your saddle height and you found a saddle height that makes your back not hurt, like me personally, I'm one of those people that's incredibly, incredibly sensitive to saddle height. If it's like a millimeter off, I can feel it in my back, right? My back will hurt after riding for a couple hours. I would just have to quit that team immediately if they told me that that saddle height was the millimeter off, because I know what it needs to be. It's a batshit insane policy, and I wonder what other things that they are controlling to that level.
They get a lot of homework.
It's astonishing to me that they get a lot of homework.
They get homework to do, so they have to riders have to write reports on things, is what I've heard.
Oh my god!
And if you don't
to do a end of day reflections in your DSM planner.
I think that's how I understand it. And then if you don't do it, then you get and a lot of the time the punishment is just more meetings. So then you have meetings to talk about why you didn't go to that meeting or why you didn't do that piece of coursework.
Yeah, that sounds awful. It's one thing to say, yeah, but your power numbers are better at this, whatever. But if you can't move because your back hurts, then that's ridiculous.
Yeah, if I suddenly start just pulling all-nighters and writing better features than I do now and then sleeping during my daytime, and then Kaylee's like, no, you have to be, you have to work UK time 9 to 5, a time when Colorado isn't awake. You have to work that time, do less good work. Less good? That's not a word. It doesn't matter. Maybe if
well,
I did
it's two words, but you could use the word worse instead if you wanted to.
I'll think about it. But yeah, it's like that. It's
just
nuts.
Insane. It's completely insane. It is bananas, as you say, Kit. I don't understand it, and I never will, and I cannot imagine riding for that team. Every time we hear one of these stories, I'm just shocked. I'm shocked.
I like it, though, because it gives them a sort of edge that they wouldn't have otherwise, because they are kind of a bit dull sometimes. They're very well media trained. They're kept on a tight leash with things they say. And so it gives them an edge. Otherwise, I wouldn't really mind. And also, it's weirder because now they've got a big Australian vibe in their team. Their tour squad was basically all Australians and guys like Sam Welsford, who looks like he likes to kick back in the off season with at least seven beers. and then they did the weird thing with the time trial where they missed their start time. And then they were media trained out of telling us exactly what happened. But I'm just now imagining the sort of punishment that they got for missing a time trial start.
You would hope it would be bigger than changing your saddle height.
Exactly.
Because it's an actual problem as opposed to one that they've just made up in their minds. Right. Okay. We're leaving this behind. We will obviously keep an eye on the insanity that is DSM Firmenich. Have we style guided this yet?
No.
I'm going with Firmenich. Anyway, as we hear more weird stories about this team, we will keep you up to date, audience, listeners.
Well, Van Houck seems very, very much happier back home, getting polka dot jerseys back on a Ridley bike. Anyway, that's, after 6 months at DSM, he's suddenly very much happier.
Oh, yeah.
And getting polka dot jerseys with Lot of Destiny again. But maybe that's a bit too spicy for...
Wait, no, I don't think...
way
nothing's
too
spicy.
Ham Van Heppenius is always too spicy.
He seems like the sweetest guy in the peloton. He's always got a kind of, I don't really know what I'm doing sort of face on him. But he seems to ride very well.
Anyway. I want to move on to the Tour de l'Avenir, which just wrapped up. The men's one just wrapped up, and the women's one is on right now. We're two stages into the women's one, maybe three by the time we finish this recording. So we'll talk more about that in a future episode. This is the first ever edition of the women's Tour de l'Avenir. Very exciting, or at least the first in a very long time. I'm pretty sure it's the first ever. Yeah, super exciting because the sort of the opportunities for kind of espoir U23 age young female cyclists have been few and far between. Generally, for the women's peloton, you just get chucked straight from the juniors into the full-on pros, right? And so this is a really interesting opportunity for some of these young riders to show what they can do against their actual peers, as opposed to you're suddenly lining up with Annemiek van Vleuten and Demi Vollering, and good luck to you. Right. So that's great. We'll talk more about it next week. Brief Aljas Turk update. After getting the placeholders bump, moved from right near the bottom of the Tour de l'Avenir up to 97th place. Well done to Aljoš Turk. We're very, very proud of you, and we're going to keep an eye on your career as you continue onwards.
The Placeholders podcast seal of approval is now 2-2, because last year our man was Archie Ryan, and he's just absolutely doing bits, as some people say.
Well, he won a stage at the Avenue last year.
Won a stage.
Yep.
Moving up to World Tour.
Signed with EF. You know, some of the other riders that we did mention last week, Matthew Riccitiello ended up in second, the young American. And then, and a nice little segue here, Isaac Del Toro, who ended up winning the Tour de l'Avenir, a Mexican rider. I believe this is a first. Sort of the pathway for young Mexican talent to get to Europe and get into sort of some of these higher profile teams has been largely broken for quite some time, unfortunately, for a whole lot of different reasons. So Isaac Del Toro pulling off this victory is massive. It's massive for Mexican cycling. It's massive for sort of like, you know, America's cycling, right? North, Central, South. I think it's great to see. And so we sent Dane Cash, who speaks Spanish and was able to chat with Isaac. We sent Dane Cash to go chat with Isaac Del Toro, the most recent winner of the Tour de l'Avenir, and a name who, well, if history is any guide, is a name we will be hearing more over the coming years, and is very likely, I think, to sign a World Tour contract. Although Dane did ask him about the UAE ties that had been reported, and he said that he hasn't heard from them. Anyway, let's throw to Dane, and we're only going to drop sort of one answer in here. Dane's going to do a bit of translation out of the Spanish, and if you want the full Q&A, head over to escapecollective.com. That story will be up on the site very soon, well, before you actually listen to this episode. So let's hear from Dane and Isaac Del Toro.
So I asked Isaac Del Toro if he could take me through a moment that was particularly memorable, one that really stood out for him from the race. And he told me the story of basically when his rivals started to kind of notice him and worry about him, really worry about him. And he was off the front with some of his fellow prospects, and essentially they're talking to each other saying, hey, we can't push the pace because Del Toro is in the group. And this was a pretty eye-opening experience for Ryder that hadn't been in that position before, where others didn't want to take him along in the group with them. So here's Del Toro explaining what happened, and I'll translate to English. I've never been a favorite, and in stage 7B, at the first mountains classification prize, I wanted it. And Riccitiello was smashing the time trial in the morning. Honestly, he's a known specialist. He put a lot of time into us. He is an incredible athlete. Well, what I wanted to do at the first mountain was go for the points. If we're going to climb full gas, I just wanted to take advantage of that. And if we're all going full gas, well, we're going to get some points. I'd be at the front. So I saw a Norwegian said to a rider from Great Britain, hey, obviously it was all in English, but stop, we can't go. And the rider from Great Britain was really angry. He said, why? He got mad. In the end, he was in second position. I was about to sprint for the points ahead of the Colombian rider Umba, and the Norwegian answered, well, because Del Toro is coming with us. And I noticed a tone of fear, of worrying. And I turned and we looked at each other in the eyes, and I honestly just thought, they're a bit afraid of me.
One of my questions that I wanted Dane to ask, and it was in the written story, is what kind of rider is he? What does he think he is? Because one of the interesting things to me about l'Avenir is that you can win it and not actually be, like, you can win a climbing stage at l'Avenir and not, when you get into the World Tour, actually be a climber, right? Because that's sort of the nature of the beast here, which is that, you know, the majority of riders of the Tour de l'Avenir are never going to make it as World Tour pros. So that the it's not as deep and not as sort of specialized as it is when they actually get to the sort of full-on pro ranks. That answer is over at escapecollective.com. Go check out the story. Again, young Mexican rider, first, I think it's the first time Mexicans even fielded a team in a couple years. And this guy's the real deal. So So head over and read that story. Last bit of news today. You might have spotted this up on the site. You spotted it elsewhere. Lachlan Morton is going to take on the Great Divide mountain bike route, which goes all the way from Canada down to Mexico along the Continental Divide in the sort of western United States. So that runs through Colorado here, for example. This is sort of separate from the Tour Divide, which is a race that happens in June. Lachlan's kind of taking this on his own. Obviously, that would not sort of disqualify him from getting a fastest known time, an FKT, for example. What will disqualify him from getting an official FKT is the fact that, once again, he's going to have a camera crew meeting him at various points throughout this thing, which is against the sort of official bike packing rules. But nonetheless, he is doing this thing, and he doesn't seem to really care about whether he gets the FKT. I would wager that he may end up with it anyway. But he's doing two interesting things. One, he's self-imposing a sleep rule. So he's going to rest for 12 out of every 48 hours. Now, normally these things are, like, to get a fastest known time on this particular route, you basically have to not sleep. And he's not really into that. It's what he did for the Colorado Trail. It's what he did for a couple of things. And he doesn't want to do that again. So I think that's valid.
Sounds like a good amount of sleep to me. 6 hours a night.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, as the parent of a toddler, that sounds fine. granted, I'm not riding my bike for the other 18.
Yeah.
So slightly different scenario than what I'm up to these next couple of weeks. But still, I think it's cool that he's sort of shifting the thought processes on that a little bit. The other thing that he's doing, and this is the other reason why we want to mention on this podcast, is he's raising funds for Adventure for All, which is a national nonprofit organization that empowers individuals with exceptionalities, so Down syndrome, autism, etc. I didn't realize this, but Lachlan has raised over $1 million.
Really?
With his various rides over the last couple of years. Wow. Sort of like the Alt Tour, which was the thing where he like rode the entire Tour de France, including the transfers, and beat the race. He rode to the Ukraine border. He's done Colorado Trail and all of these things. He's raised funds throughout. And yeah, over $1 million to various charities. So obviously this one is for a fantastic cause. We have a story up on the site. There's a link in there if you want to donate. EF is also, they've got a bunch of pages up. You can find the link to donate, and you can follow Lachlan's dot should you want to do so. So right now, I'll tell you where he is.
At the time of recording.
We're watching Kaylee try to dot watch in real time, and this is the most confused I've ever seen him.
It's quite meta almost.
Well, so it according to this, he hasn't left yet.
Okay.
Oh no, he has, because it starts in Banff, which is actually slightly north of the border. So he is literally on the Canadian border right now, about to drop into the land of the free and the home of the brave.
I thought maybe he'd started with a big sleep and then was going to get going afterwards.
Oh yeah, but that's the way to do it.
Hit the stopwatch and then fall asleep immediately. I think that's
it is a good thing to do though, because it does kind of ruin my enjoyment of like watching people do it when it basically becomes a no sleeping contest.
There's been proposals to basically require something like this for
for
events like Tour Divide, for example, because the other thing is it's quite dangerous.
Yeah, right?
And that's
really
one of the
dangerous
things that Lachlan said in this sort of press release that they sent out, which was that like one, it's not enjoyable because he can't even remember half the time that he's riding. And two, like sleep deprivation is a real thing and it can be a real problem. And you're talking about riding mountain bike trails or on roads with cars it can be a quite a dangerous thing to deprive yourself in that way. It's kind of part of the culture, I would say, but it's not particularly healthy.
Well, just 17 hours of sleep deprivation starts to, make you as clouded, as mentally inebriated as alcohol can begin to affect you. And it's equivalent of having some sort of, I think 17 hours is equivalent of 0.05 on the breathalyzer scale or something, which not insignificant. Obviously, they can't actually test you for it, but it's once you've had more than 17 hours, which a lot of bike packers do, you're starting to get into really...
Oh, easily.
Yeah, you're starting to get into really sort of inhibited states, which is, yeah, like you say, quite scary and dangerous.
Yeah, so I think we approve of this particular version that that Lachlan Morton is doing, and we, of course, doubly approve of the fact that he's doing it for a great cause. So, yeah, either head to our site and you can find that story, or like I said, EF has it up on their site. I'm sure it'll be relatively easy to find. And again, that is the Great Divide route if you're looking for the sort of the what he's doing right now. It's like 2,700 miles or so, 4,600 kilometers or something like that. That's just off the top of my head. Yeah, it's far. It'll take him like 2 weeks, basically. All right. I think it's time for a bit of a break. Welcome back, everybody. Brief corrections corner. I was pronouncing Mr. Del Toro's name quite improperly, anglifying it. I would like to apologize. Dane just texted in. His first name is pronounced Isaac. Isaac, of course, which is the sort of the Spanish version. Isaac probably would sound quite weird to him. So corrections corner right there. We regret the error. And we will do better going forward. We're going to have a new segment for everybody today. We're going to start adding listener questions to the show. We're sticking these in the member Discord. So if you are a member of Escape Collective, you can drop questions into us. I think we'll also maybe make an email available. But we're not going to say it out loud here because you got to be a member to play. Today, we're going to keep it kind of slim today, and we're just going to go with one reader question, or I should say listener question. Johnny, who are we hearing from and what do they want to know?
Today's listener question comes from David Savage, which is also a great name, and it's, how would each of the hosts of this podcast, I presume, define as specifically as possible the often invoked spirit of gravel? Good question.
Ooh, interesting.
Maybe ask slightly tongue-in-cheek. If I had to guess,
I would imagine so. I would imagine so. Kit, what do you think? What how do you define the spirit of gravel? Where might you find it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm dipping my toe in the spirit of gravel. Sounds a bit weird out loud, but I don't know. I think no rules is kind of what I've, and certainly when as it was growing a few years ago and becoming more and more popular before the UCI got involved, it felt like a kind of, I don't know, bring what you have fun, stay safe, ride with your mates, doesn't matter about the numbers, just get outside on your bike, away from the traffic, and it doesn't have to be particularly fast, just having fun. I think that's kind of, as I said, that's not very specific or concise, but it's kind of how I've, that's why I bought an off-road bike. Get off the road, or at least get away from the bike computer, and don't worry about aero, hairy legs, you know, all that. Maybe that's the spirit of gravel, hairy legs. That's specific.
There we go. The spirit of gravel is hairy legs. The Gravel Worlds was, I think, last weekend or the weekend before, and the guy that came in second, I was looking at Ben Delaney's YouTube. Friend of the podcast, Ben Delaney. If you haven't checked out the ride that Ben does, Ben had a little thing with... the guy that came in second place there, and what caught my eye was the fact that he was running basically a rear disc wheel. He's running a head wheel that is like the spokes on it are literally like 10 centimeters wide or something like that, and the whole rest of it is rim. So it's basically a disc wheel, and I would say that is not the spirit of gravel. The opposite of that.
Was this the World Championships? I thought the World Championships were in October.
No,
this is gravel.
Yeah.
This is Gravel Worlds.
See,
different from the World Championships, right? Yeah.
The
Johnny?
The Spirit of Gravel is having two world championships, I think. And I was privileged enough to attend the UCI World Gravel Championships last year. And I think the Spirit of Gravel was after the finish. I can't remember the very pretty Italian town it was held in.
Veneto.
Veneto, that was it.
Yeah.
And as we came out of the press centre, there was like normal Italian folks sitting around having Aperol Spritz. And then there was just like one pickup truck. I don't think the people were American, but they were sort of wearing jean shorts, flannel shirts, and they were like drinking like tiny beers. And just like that set against the background of like beautiful, very old Italian city. I think that was the most obvious thing that was a Spirit of Gravel to me. So tiny beers, jean shorts, flannel shirts.
The most succinct description of all of my friends that has ever been said on this podcast.
Seeing as they're lifetime members, maybe I shouldn't have said that.
and myself. That's also fine. So the Spirit of Gravel is definitely Hairy Legs, 100%. The Spirit of Gravel is definitely not aerodynamic anything. The Spirit of Gravel is absolutely flannel shirts and tiny beers and a pickup truck. Maybe not a pickup truck. We can take or leave the pickup truck. Spirit of Gravel is actually mountain bikes. That's what most people don't realize is that Spirit of Gravel is.
You have that t-shirt, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah, I have a t-shirt that says it, which is proof that that is the case.
Another version of this answer would be the early 20th century Tour de France, because that's all on gravel.
Wow. Yeah.
The Alt Tour. Lachlan Morton's Alt Tour is the Spirit of Gravel.
Mm.
Right?
Well, yeah, but I mean specifically it was on gravel, you know, riding through on the Tourmalet on a horrible gritted road.
Also very true.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we solved it.
Began.
We've solved it for David Savage. David, thank you for dropping your question in. If you have more questions for us, they can be anything. We can solve your deep philosophical conundrums. We can answer things semi-succinctly. There is a thread in the Discord where you can drop those questions in. And should I offer people an email?
Yeah, give them mine, because I only get emails from people sending me pictures of washing machines, so I'd like to switch it up a bit. I don't even get all the press releases from the teams because they refuse to add me to the list. So literally that's all my inbox is.
So let's do it. Let's do Johnny's inbox a favor. If you are a member, and let's make the rule here, you have to include your member number.
Yes.
In this, which is when you're logged into the site, it says it up at the top next to your name. You got to include your member number, then you can ask a question. You send an email over to Johnny, that's JONNY, no H, johnny.long@escapecollective.com.
L-O-N-G.
L-O-N-G. No E at the end. He's not fancy.
I'm not fancy. I would also like to accept some questions in sort of the agony aunt variety, but don't make them about like your relationships. Make them about like a bit bike related, like maybe your club or like group ride stuff. Not that I've ever done any group riding, but I would just like to give answers to these problems without any experience, because I feel like maybe I'll come to some answers you'd never thought of.
What is agony aunt?
Oh my god, you'd love it.
Oh, it's great. Okay, so basically it's generally speaking, it's sort of middle-aged women who have columns in national newspapers in the UK, and people send in like their relationship troubles, like things their husbands have done.
Dear Jane.
Yeah. This person gives them advice. And depending on the publication, comes with a varying degree of usefulness. But it's like a big, it's like a format.
Sometimes it'll be useful and it'll be, you know, very serious gardening tips. And sometimes it'll be completely satirical nonsense, which is the more fun version, which I think is what Johnny's going for.
Yeah. So send us your agony aunts. If you are having troubles with your relationship with anything, your bicycle, your significant other, your best friend, your
mother,
your washing machine. Mm-hmm. We want to hear about your relationship troubles. Johnny.long@escapecollective.com, or drop them into our Discord, please and thank you. All right, we have two more segments today. First, we're going to go talk with Dave Rome about a bigger wheel size. We're going to do a bit of tech in this episode. This will be a quick little bit, but it was one of the most interesting things to come out of the last week or two in the tech world. So we're going to chat with Dave Rome about that. And then we're coming back and we're going to quiz Kit and Johnny, who haven't listened to this conversation, about this new wheel size.
Great.
Let's hear from Dave. Okay, so tell me a little bit more about this actual wheel size. You said it's not quite a 32.
Yeah.
It's bigger than a 29. So 700C road size is a 29-inch wheel. Same.
Yeah.
This is 750D. Where does this number come from? What is this?
Yeah, so I mean, 29er is basically a 700C wheel with a bigger tire that then measures 29-inch. This is effectively trying to match that, but with a skinnier tire. So it's kind of, imagine a 29 by, say, 2.2-inch mountain bike tire. It's quite baggy. It's quite big. It looks like a mountain bike tire. You've got all the weight of it. 750D, at least from what, say, WTB is currently doing, the goal is to basically have a 40mm gravel tire with the same diameter as that 29 by 2.2-inch tire. So you get all the same rollover benefits of it. You get the same sort of... the rollover benefits, which then mean equals speed. You know, the wheel stalls less over, you know, you don't need to keep re-accelerating it over bumpy terrain. But you don't have the same sort of wide bag that you're sort of having to drag around on road and smoother terrain.
Okay, like I get it in theory. I totally get it in theory. And I'm wondering if I'm just being a grouchy old coot. It doesn't feel like if it's big enough to make me want to get a new wheel size, basically. Like, if we're going to go for it, just put a 36 on there, you know? Like, let's just go for it. And this just feels like sort of another reason to buy different things.
Yeah, and that's certainly, I think, a very fair complaint against it, is it is only where the tire bead diameter is only, I believe, 38mm larger than the current wheels that everyone rides. So it's not a big difference when you consider that's, you know, roughly 1.9 centimeters on either side of the wheel. It adds 1.9 centimeters to the bike height, basically. So it's you're talking about a pretty minute difference here, and it's questionable as to whether we need this. And yeah, as you say, it's like, why not just go to 32-inch wheels, which are bigger and potentially better again. And the problem is the bigger the wheel you go, the more compromises you end up introducing with geometry and things like toe overlap and chainstay lengths and all these other things. So yeah, there's always compromises, and I think for WTB they're trying to find a healthy balance. But yes, it's a lot of change for what is currently questionable gain.
All right, last question. Do you like it?
No. I mean, so the thing is I haven't ridden it, so I'm not super well placed to say whether I like it or not. I think any time the new standard is introduced is worth coming out with a lot of hesitation, because it is going to create more confusion in the marketplace, and it dilutes options, and it increases costs of things. So there's a lot of negatives to having a new standard like this. But that said, every new standard that's ever come out that has then become a standard, say 29er mountain bikes, was met with very, very similar hatred, and took not that many years before everyone just accepted it as the new norm. So I've been in this game long enough to not discount something until I've ridden it and seen some data around how it is going.
All right. It's a bit of a hedge there. We're just going to clip out your initial answer and just stick with that, I think. We'll just go with no. That's where I'm at the moment.
Yeah, cool. All right.
All right, thanks, Dave.
Cheers.
All right, Kit, Johnny, welcome to your weekly pain. This week's quiz show is based entirely on this new 750D wheel size, which is bigger than 700C, also bigger than 29, smaller than 32, and smaller than 36.
Golly.
Got it.
As a brief update on the current weekly pain standings. I put these standings in our Discord and then realized, actually Dane realized, that I had screwed it up. So currently, Dane and Kit, you are both tied on 4 points. The way that we've decided to do this is it's going to be run basically like a football/soccer league. A win gets you 3 points, a draw gets you 1 point, a loss gets you 0 points. So currently, we've got Dane and Kit in the lead with 4 points. We've got Ian with 1 point. Johnny, Ronan, and me, I don't know why I'm in there because I'm asking the questions, we all have 0 points. So this is an opportunity for either Kit to take a commanding lead or Johnny to play some catch up. Let's get into the questions here.
I've actually sat forward in my seat ready for this. I don't know why.
So you're each going to get 2 questions here. If you get a correct answer, you get like 1 point. If you get it wrong, you get 0 points. Whoever ends up with most points at the end gets the big points, the 3 points. If we end up with a 2-2 tie, I do have a tiebreaker. Who wants to go first? Kit, you're first?
Yep, fine.
All right. According to Nate Bradley, Moot's chief frame designer, what is the primary benefit of the larger 750D wheel size? It is A, increased tire volume for better traction, B, improved agility and maneuverability, or C, lengthening the contact patch for better stability and float on soft surfaces.
What was the first one?
Increased tire volume for better traction.
I'm going to go, for no reason other than, I don't even know, C.
Correct.
Yes. Maybe I so did learn have, something working in a bike shop.
You have 1 point. The correct answer, of course, was lengthening the contact patch for better stability and float on soft surfaces. Of course. I should mention that it was very purposeful that I'm asking a bunch of tech questions to two of the people on staff who probably care the least about the thing that I'm asking them about. Johnny, you're up.
Okay.
Why did Moots shorten the head tube length on the prototype Route CRDD? A, to accommodate boost spacing. B, to match the geometry of the Chris King aero set. C, to compensate for the larger fork that accommodates 750 by 40 millimeter tires.
The problem is, by this point, I've been so like Pavlovianly trained to just dip out and not listen when someone on the podcast is talking about tech that it was even a struggle to like pay attention when you're just talking to me. What was the first one again?
Accommodate for boost spacing.
I'm gonna go C as well.
Correct. We have a tie game thus far. The correct answer, of course, is to compensate for the larger fork that accommodates a 750D by 40 millimeter tire.
That does make sense. Kit, they're now thinking about it. Yeah.
Kit, we're back. Kit, we're back to you. According to the story that Dave Rome put up on the site, what is the bead seat diameter of the prototype 750D wheel size?
Oh, we're getting thrown in the. I don't know. This feels like a. I'm being chewed out for not reading my colleague's work now.
A, 660 millimeters. B, 700 millimeters. C, 750 millimeters. What is your answer? Again, the prototype 750D wheel size bead seat diameter.
What's a bead seat diameter?
It's basically the diameter of the rim at the beads, like the outermost point. Yeah.
Yeah. Can I have the options again, please?
A 660, B 700, C 750.
Can I go B?
B is incorrect.
Yep. Well,
unfortunately.
Surprised.
It is A. The bead seat diameter of the 750D wheel size is, in fact, 660 millimeters.
Well, I knew it wasn't going to be C because that would be silly.
That would just make too much sense. All right, Johnny, back to you. This is your opportunity to take all of the marbles today. What is the potential challenge with the 750D wheel size mentioned in Dave's story in relation to existing curing machines? The wheels are too heavy to be balanced properly. The 750D size is incompatible with most frames. The size is too large. for those machines.
Oh, that was three options.
Yeah.
One more time, please.
What is the potential challenge
yeah.
with the 750D wheel size in relation to curing?
Mm-hmm.
The wheels are too heavy to be balanced properly. The 750D size is incompatible with most frames. The size is too large for the existing machines.
The problem with this one is the first questions, it was obvious which one was like just sort of marketing like gumph. Like, so I've edited enough of these like pieces now to know just like what is how they, because they all write in that same tone.
It almost feels like there's a trick question in this one too, which there might not be, but it feels a little bit like that might be it.
Yeah, and the problem is I'm probably going to pick that one because I'm like, yeah, that makes sense, obviously. I'm going to go with the middle one about them being too big.
Incorrect. Incorrect.
Oh, fuck. I would have done the same thing, Johnny.
It was not a trick question. The actual answer was they just don't fit in the curing machines. That is the problem with the curing.
Why have they made them like that then? Why would you make them like that?
So we have a tie. And the way that we're going to break this tie is I'm going to ask you. Nope, this is not a tech question.
Uh-oh.
This is a quote from a high profile general manager in the World Tour. And you are going to guess which general manager I'm talking about. Okay. And this is literally the first person to shout the name out.
Well, Johnny's got a lag, so that's good for me.
Here's your quote. This is a very strong group of riders who are ready to take on this race. We start every Grand Tour hungry for the win, and I know every single rider is going to give everything for the team and each other. Johnny, you are correct.
I was going to say the wrong name anyway. So that's good.
That was Rod Ellingworth. Exactly. With a completely bland quote ahead of the Vuelta a España. Johnny takes home all of the marbles, takes 3 points. Congratulations. Johnny, you are now in, basically third place. It goes Dane and Kit still tied on 4. Johnny with 3. Ian with 1. Ronan still hasn't been on the show since we added this and still has 0. Well done, all.
I feel so tired now.
I feel myself getting really competitive.
Yeah, same.
And then when Johnny's on his last question and I've got 2 and I'm waiting. Yeah, it's funny. It's like being with my siblings at Christmas.
I very much enjoy it. All right, well, that's it for us this week. Thanks to everybody for joining along, for putting us in your ears. As always, head over to escapecollective.com/join. If you listen to this podcast regularly, it's really the least you could do. Let's head over and join up because it supports everything that we do here at Escape Collective. It's the reason why we can do everything that we do. So head over and do that, please and thank you. And that's it. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Placeholder Podcast. The last thing I'm going to leave you with before we shut the recorders off is this week's correct answers. This week's correct answers are Sam Welsford, Simon and Adam Yates, Tadej Pogacar, Wout Poels, Jai Hindley, Magnus Cort, Julian Alaphilippe, Florian Vermeersch, and Alexander Kristoff, of course. We'll see you next week.